My name is Misha Bilenka, and Alexei Kamenev and Ye Xing are going to talk to you about deep learning for a whole hour about all of it. Not quite, but we'll try. So this is oriented to be a broad overview, so apologies to those of you who are experts. We'll be very happy to talk to you after the talk with all the details. So what's the big deal about deep learning? Because it really works for some domains. That's really the big deal. In the past 10 years, there were really dramatic improvements in the quality of lots of vision problems and speech recognition, primarily because multi-layer neural networks with lots of complicated structure have been applied to them. That's a fact. At the same time, there is a lot of excitement about them being useful for lots of other things, which has not yet come to fruition in terms of actual results, That's not bad, that's okay, because there's a lot of people trying and doing really interesting work, especially in NLP. It seems like there's definitely active progress and there may be breakthroughs in not too far. But at the same time, it's not about just specific vision or speech problems. The nice thing is that it takes a lot of work, but once you have a model, you can reuse it. Once you train the model for a task and spend a lot of effort, you can then, as we'll cover in a bit, we'll you'd be using it as a featurizer for lots of other tasks. So if you just train a model to recognize lots of image categories, the same model can be useful to train to tell apart dog breeds. And that's sort of the nice generic thing, so because it's not just specific problems. And finally, the truth is that neural nets, even though they've been around for a while and sort of they come in and out of favor, are a darn good learner when they're well implemented and when the parameters are tuned. They're, for nonlinear problems, they're kind of a workhorse algorithm in most toolkits alongside tree ensembles and SVMs if you really have strong nonlinearity. And with enough training data, you can get state-of-the-art results with it. So in domains where people really, really care, like click prediction, for example, people who have tried lots of things, they typically find that actually doesn't really matter whether you're using neural nets or boosted trees. As long as you spend enough time tuning it, you will get a state-of-the-art nonlinear predictor of it. And so that's why they're useful and they sort of shouldn't be dusted away as they were just about 10 years ago. Okay, so but then the question is, why did they suddenly explode? Well, partially because these results were pretty dramatic in terms of gains over the state-of-the-art for vision and speech. But partially also because the data sets are finally here to train them. And we also, not just the data sets, but also the hardware. So even though technically the same convolutional nets were around in the 90s, really, at the same time, there's no way we could have trained them with the same amount of parameters or on the same amount of data. So that's why it's really a case of, and some of the latest tricks, of course, help, but really the core concepts are actually not that new. But that doesn't mean that the new tricks are not exciting. So just a quick refresher for what they are. Again, so for those of you who are unfamiliar, hopefully this will be sort of a useful couple of slides. So at the end of the day, neural net, hopefully all of you are familiar with linear models, basic regression of some sort. And you can think of neural nets as a natural expansion of that, where instead of a single neural net, instead of a single linear model, you're now taking a whole bunch of them, then the output of each one will go through a nonlinear transformation, and then you're going to now stack them on top of each other. So in this picture, you can see that basically there is inputs at the bottom, and then these inputs go into this first bank of hidden nodes. Each one of them has its own set of weights and a bias, and then it goes through this sigmoid, through this little curly transformation. And then all of these guys are now inputs to the next layer, where now, if you're doing, say, in this example, we're doing multi-class classification. So there's a number of outputs corresponding to number of classes. So as a result, we're now taking those features that are the outputs of the initial layer and treating them as features to the next layer. So that actually sounds pretty simple. In the bottom there, you can see that it means we just have a bunch of features x1 through xn. For every unit, we're just taking multiplying each of them by weight and then putting them through some combiner function f. If you're into linear algebra, you can think of it as just doing the dot product on the weights versus the input and doing same thing on each successive layer afterwards. So this was a sort of a very simple example, but then what is deep? Deep just means that instead of doing this once for a single hidden layer, we can do it multiple times, and we can be more creative in terms of how we combine them and which become inputs and how they structure. So this is sort of another cartoon of the same problem. Suppose we have an input image that's 28 by 28 pixels. We can just kind of elongate it. We don't really care about which pixels are next to each other at this point. We're putting them through some number of hidden units, say 50, and then say if we're predicting if each image is a digit, there's going to be 10 outputs. So one thing we can do immediately is that, well, what if we using two layers instead of one? And so now we just repeat the same structure, but all of them are connected to all of them. So all the inputs for each layer are the outputs of the previous layer. So that helps with enough data. However, we can be a lot more creative, and that's where the convolutions come in. So the point is that now we don't have to take all the inputs, because the original image is not just an array. It's actually a little 2D surface. So there's certain things are next to other things. And if we care about, for example, recognizing certain types of structure in there, we probably don't care about where in the image it occurs, because when you take the picture, you could just shift it. So that's what convolutions do at the end of the day. You can think of convolutions as a special layer where instead of connecting to every single thing underneath it, connects to a small subset, and then you just kind of slide that subset over so that you basically think of it as running a little feature detector over the image, doing a complete scan. And in the end, you're basically getting a layer which says, well, I did see this kind of picture in the left corner, in the left top, in the right corner, and so on. So you can think of convolutions as basically banks of feature detectors. The key point is that they're not given or designed, they're trained. So the actual whether the in this convolution bank, where the bottom layer is going to try to catch certain type of an edge or a certain type of a squirrely, is really up to the trainer. And then what has been observed is that if you have multiple of these, you repeat this multiple times with lots of data, if you try to visualize like what do these things really kind of catch, it turns out that they actually do catch the successive layers of complexity in terms of featurization. So if you think of like what are the basic visual features, there are things like edges or sort of patterns. That's what usually happens in reality, is that basically the first bank will tend to get very simple things like edges, and then higher up you will start getting patterns, and hence like the publicity generating cat outlier sort of outlines in the YouTube data sets, if any of you have seen that. So that's pretty much it about what deep nets are. Obviously, I'm not doing much justice to a giant, very active field, but again, the goal here is to catch up. So how do these things train? Again, it sounds very mysterious, and in sort of popular press, sometimes there's lots of talk about brains and things like that. But in reality, it's just gradient descent at the end of the day. We're starting with some random weights, so it produces kind of gobbledygook random garbage. And then we try to move the weights to where it produces something that's less garbage. We take a training set, we define the output on that train set as our cost function, or a discrepancy of the output with the true labels. And then we successively modify the weights to give us better predictions. And a lot of the trickery comes now from the question, well, do you sort of aggregate the error over the entire set and then do an update, sort of known as batch update, or do you do it one by one, known as stochastic gradient descent? If you have multiple layers, do you do it one layer at a time? You should. And lots of fancier tricks on how do you actually do the actual update, what, and so on. So that's really where a lot of the really cool stuff came out, is really in the mechanics of the weight updates. That, again, not to take away from the field, there is a ton of really nice tricks that came up. But at the end of the day, it's just gradient descent, just like you are doing with your basic 100-year-old logistic regression. So another question is that, OK, now that we've seen a lot of these very cool work in recent years, and there's all these acronyms, so DNNs, convolutional CNNs, RNNs, LSTMs, and so on, the often raised question is like, well, we heard LSTMs are the latest and greatest. Can we use that for everything? And sadly, the answer is no. If you're sort of skeptical of why, the kind of most foundational result justifying the no is known as the no-free lunch theorem. And the popular interpretation is that you cannot have a single learner that will be always best. You just can't. So, but that also justifies why it's good to support a variety of these things, because depending on the problem you have, in one case you may want to have just a single hidden layer full connected. In another case, it makes sense to actually design more of a custom connectivity structure that would capture certain properties of your images, or in the case of speech, you want to capture the temporal structure of the signal. So that's good news. And then that means tools are important, and that's why we who are in Cortana Analytics Azure ML work on, among other things, DNNs, care about allowing to express a variety of different neural nets within the tools we provide. So to do that, I mean, that sounds complicated, because if you recall the pictures, there's like these graphs and there's lots of types of connectivity. And there's obviously been a lot of work on this because it's important. But one thing we've done is we kind of stepped back from saying, well, is it better represented as an XML file or a config file? And we figured that actually having a proper language for it will be useful. And turns out it is. So one of the designers was a designer of C#. So we called it NetSharp, also because it has some resemblance. And I'll give a few examples in a second. But the point of having a language for the topology is that is twofold. So first of all, we can easily specify what is the topology in a kind of a nice computer science-y programmatic way. And we can have things like functions in there. So for example, we can say that we want connections between pixels that are within a certain radius, unless there is something else is being represented and so on. So basically, you can have more logic in there. You can also represent models with it. At this point, basically, you think of it as a bunch of constants representing what the weights are and what are the types of the activation functions on the different layers. So that makes it more general than just kind of storing the configuration of either the model or a saved bunch of weights. And so that's done inside the language by having two structures, so to kind of two core concepts. So one is we want these core layer types, connection bundles. So fully connected, filtered, convolutional, pooling, I mean, these are sort of first order objects in the language, so making it much easier to specify different types of convolutions. And then things like weight sharing for RNNs, for example, is supported. And then the other piece is the activation function. So this nonlinearity in the node through which the dot product coming in goes through. So the basic one is known as a sigmoid, but then 10H is a close cousin. But there's the latest and greatest ones like ReLU and so on are also supported. And again, everything is expandable. So if somebody wants to code up a really fancy one, it's pretty easy for us to take it. And then another thing, that going back to the point about the model input and output, is that suppose somebody is really, really fond of their open source package like Caffe. That's fine. There's lots of exciting things happening there. And we want to be able to leverage whatever is being trained there. So that makes it also easy for us to import models from other packages on demand. So kind of to dive this further, what is like the basic topology look like? So you guys can see that hopefully, right, the text. So this is a basic single hidden layer net. And here in NetSharp, we will just describe each layer in a single statement. We'll say that the input is a picture. We could have said 28, we could say 20 by 28. We could have actually just written as a single vector. And then we just say that there's a hidden layer which takes input from the picture, from the input layer, and all means it's fully connected. And then the output layer, again, we're defining it as a result. Suppose we're doing digit prediction, so it's going to be 10, a vector of 10 nodes. And then here we defined a layer type called softmax just to make it work for prediction of the actual digits. So correspondingly, for two hidden layers, we just add another layer in the middle called H2, which then takes from H1. In this case, we decided to be creative and used 10H instead of the default sigmoid as the connection, as activation type for it. But the output is still a result. But then, of course, the convolution is the fun stuff. So here is a quick example of a basic convolution layer. So one thing I didn't say earlier is that you can, since it's language, you can have things like constants and variables, which is also nice, because now, I suppose today you're getting 28 by 28, tomorrow you'll get 256 by 256. The same spec can work. You just make a variable for your size of the image, and then the rest you can do through variables. So in this case, the convolution layer, is ReLU, so R linear, and then from data. So the previous layer, here's the best example. Suppose we have three channels, red, green, blue. They're 224 by 224. So this is your input. And now we're defining a convolution, so this sort of bank of these feature detectors that'll be trained. And then they have their own parameters, such as the input shape, which repeats what comes in, and then how big those little detectors are going to be that'll slide over, how many of them are there, how it'll behave on reaching the edge of the image, and so on. So that makes it pretty flexible. Another sort of sometimes used, often used structure is that, well, what if you want to define, instead of kind of co-training everything together, you want to actually kind of train two separate nets, but then have them come together for combining later. And so this is an example here on the right. So that's pretty easy. You just define different inputs taken from different outputs. What you often do afterwards is that you apply what's known as max pooling. So after you've think of it as sliding your feature detector, and then suppose you trained one that finds a cat, and it goes, no cat here, no cat here, no cat here, so sort of a cat here, ooh, definitely a cat here. If you're trying to find cats, what you want now is you don't care where the cat is, you just want to know if it ever said yes. So max pooling on top of convolution does that. It will basically pick out where, like, what is the maximum value that was produced by any of the previous layers' inputs. And again, you do this by specifying certain parameters of how you're going to slide over the previous layer and, like, calculate the maximum there. So parameters like stride and so on. So this is all well documented. And so this is great, but then it sounds like a lot of work, because now it's, okay, you have to go read all this documentation about neural nets, go start reading papers and textbooks and so on, and it'd be nice if someone could just do it for you, or you could assign it to somebody, and then they would come up with this once, and then you would just use it for all wonderful vision things. So this goes to the point of deep learning being very good for learning your presentations in general. So what that means is that for most other algorithms, before you put in your raw features, your pixels or your, say, the phones from the, if you're doing speech, you actually have to apply kind of mechanically designed transformations for edge detectors, for certain contrast type features and so on. And the great promise of nets is that here you're just putting in raw pixels. And then it's up to these layers to then learn these higher order functions so that at the very top, you're basically ending up with a really nice low-dimensional representation that you can then just predict on. So then if that's such a nice representation, that means that it doesn't matter what the last layer is trained for. We can just reuse it. And it turns out to be very much the case. So if we just think of it as just covering up the last layer, that's doing the actual predictions. So in this case, suppose we trained a predictor for digits. What if we, instead of digits, we now want to predict letters or letters in a different alphabet? It turns out that middle layer actually is not a bad representation for it, especially if you are, again, spent the time on creating something as complex as here, even though that's kind of complex kind of as of 6 years ago. Now it goes about three times the size. But the point is that you just cover up the last layer, and now whatever all this work that someone did to win in their academic ImageNet competition can be reused to do detection of everyday objects in your specific application that you actually care about. And that's really the big deal, because vision has historically been a very much a deep expertise, I mean, not to pun, but the area, and then this really democratizes the field in terms of anybody can now train detectors or recognizers, classifiers on raw images using these state-of-the-art converters of representation. So the question is, okay, that sounds great, but does it really help? How much do I gain? So this is where, in a couple of minutes, Alexei will really demonstrate this with some nice experiments and examples. But this is sort of state-of-the-art results from folks who've been very successful in some of these competitions known as ImageNet. And they've actually went ahead and they've done experiments where they compared different types of connectivity and then just stacking up more layers and seeing, like, what is the gain. So in this one, they're looking at the number of hidden layers for either two fully connected layers or one fully connected layer. And then they're seeing on the vertical, like, well, do you gain in accuracy? And as always, after a while, it becomes not important. If you had, you know, n times more data, you probably would still keep rising. But at least at the current rate, that there's kind of a natural saturation point. And another sort of way to look at that is that here, They're comparing, again, different types of models. The one in green is actually 11 layers, so that's a kind of cousin of the one that was just on the bottom. And you can see that, okay, for 11 layers, it actually doesn't, it matters less how many parameters you have, so you can get away with sort of think of them as narrower layers, but it does help to have all this complexity in terms of different layers that does give you that much better results. Even if you shrink it to a number of parameters that way fewer than having like really big, wide, fully connected few layers. So that's a pretty strong argument for why actually design of these topologies and these topologies really matter, as opposed to just packing more hidden units into a two-layer or a three-layer net. And so that's why there's no really easy answer to how deep do you want to be. So just to give you a data point, so that's why for ImageNet, the current sort of state of the art bar for competing seriously is about 20 layers with, again, somewhat exotic designs. But you know, several years from now, they become sort of canonical designs, just like the one I showed you, now known by everybody as AlexNet, by the first name of the author. And so the point of all of this, at least a partial point, was that, okay, we actually want to share all this. We spend lots of time playing with all this stuff, but we want to share. And that's what Cortana Analytics, Azure ML, tries to do. So we make it easy to for you to start doing this stuff. So the demos that will follow will cover that in detail. But for now, I'll just kind of give you the quick intro into getting there. So if you are in Studio of Azure ML, you go to Gallery. And in Gallery, you can just search for neural network, and then you basically get these nice examples. So let me start from the beginning. So if you're in Gallery, you search for neural network, you get a bunch of results from these samples, and they're basically complete examples. So say the one with two hidden layers is right here. Woo, my bad. Okay, I need to do the two. Let me see if you can just drag it. Yeah, there we go. Oh, sorry. Thank you. Yep, will do in a second. All right, okay. So I started, okay, this is Studio. You just go to Gallery, search for neural nets. You see all the great examples that folks have put in, and then there are a few pretty basic ones, like here's one hidden layer to hidden layer. So let's say we'll take this one, and then it just opens Studio, and then it opens the whole experiment with the data sets and everything for you, so you can train two-layer neural nets like a champ right away. So you say okay, and there, this is what it looks like. I assume you guys have seen earlier demos of Studio and how things work, but the magic piece in this case is this. So this is the neural net. The rest is just the data sets that go, the training data set, the train model. You can see there's no featureizers, as promised, just raw pixels. And then in here is where you can either, for fully connected single layer, you can just say fully connected case. But here, custom, we actually are putting in this net sharp right here, the same one. And then that's exactly the network that you can now run, train, and get good results that you'll see in a second on recognizing digits. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Alexei, who will talk a little more about, well, what does it mean to then actually try to have more layers, and what does it matter in practice? Because that's what we all care about.
Thank you, Misha. Can everybody hear me? Excellent. My name is Alexei Kamenev. I'm an engineer in Microsoft Research. I'm working on distributed deep learning projects right now, and I used to work in Azure Machine Learning on neural network implementation and other things. So I'm going to do the very simple demo. And for this demo, I will be using the sort of the Drosophila of machine learning data set, which is called MNIST. By the way, how many people heard or know about MNIST? Okay, quite a few. For those of you who do not know, as I said, this is a very, very basic, very popular data set, which most of the machine learning practitioners and the researchers are using. And it's a multi-class classification problem. Essentially, the task is to recognize the digits, handwritten digits. And it's relatively small. By modern standard science standards. It's 60,000 training images and 10,000 testing images. For this demo, I will be using the three topologies, the one hidden layer, fully connected hidden layer, two fully connected hidden layers, and the convolutional one. And I will discuss the performance of each of these topologies separately. Now let me launch. All right, so let's load the models that I mentioned. Let's load the first model. This is the pre-trained models. And then the second model, and then the last model. And now let's actually take a look at the few images from the test data set, from the MNIST test data set. So now in this image, you see that this is the actual digit 5. You see this, the ground truth is 5, the label is 5. However, on the right side, you see the confidence of each model in predicting the digit. So for example, the first model, the simple one hidden layer model, gets it wrong, right? So it thinks that it's 6. It kind of little bit, there is some certainty that it might be 5, but again, 6 is definitely much, much higher. And then the rest of the model, two models, they pretty confident that this is 5, which is the correct answer. This one is more or less clear. It's 7. All three models are correct. And then this is the 3. And then again, we see that all three models are correct. But then the second model, it kind of thinks that it might be 5. So again, we clearly see that the model, the deep neural network model, it actually has three convolutional layers and three pooling layers. So it's much more complex. But even on such relatively simple data sets, it performs much, much better. And then a couple of other examples, like this one. Again, the convolutional model, the deep model, gives the right answer. And two other models, they produce the wrong answers. And this one, yeah, that's kind of interesting. The first, the simple model, surprisingly produces the good answer, the correct answer. The second model makes a mistake. And the third model, which we think is the best, it produces the correct answer, but then it's sort of a bit confused. And it thinks that it might be also the 8. But again, it produces the correct answer. Okay, so this is from the beginning. And let me actually do something else. Is this, no, this is not touch interface. But okay, let me grab it here. I'm going to draw numbers using my finger. you will not see it because I have two screens. Okay, again, this is what I've just drawn. All models are correct. Let me draw, sorry about that. Yeah. Okay, again, the same result. The convolutional model is always right. So the deep learning works. But surprisingly, shallow learning works as well, which is good. And again, the second model is confused. And if I added this, I changed it slightly. Again, it's very hard to fool the convolutional model, deep model. But now it's pretty easy to fool the simple models. All right, so that's it about the demo. And a couple of words I want to say is that, and then Misha mentioned it already. So there are a lot of tools and the frameworks that you can use to train the models. The problem is that how do you sort of make it into production? And the Cortana Analytics allows you to do both the training and then staging it as a web service for the consumption. So it's a relatively straightforward and simple process. And the IE will show you how to do it from the Azure ML portal. Thank you.
So, can you guys hear me? Yeah, okay. So my name is Ye Xing. I'm a data scientist in Azure Machine Learning team. So the demo today that I'm going to show you is to show you how to build a deep neural net to recognize digits on Azure ML, and then how to build a web service around this model, and then finally how to consume the model from a phone app. So let's go to the studio. So the demo that we are going to do is to recognize the digits. We use the same data set as Alexis showed. It is from the MNIST data set. So each MNIST image is represented by one handwritten digit in black and white color. And the model is trying to learn the different shapes of the handwritten digit, and then trying to predict what is the real digit on the image. So this example, the experiment for the using the basic convolution neural net to recognize a digit. You can see that this experiment follows the traditional data science workflow. We train the model on the training set and score the model on the scoring set, on the testing set, and then evaluate the model to see the performance. And as we have 10 digits to recognize, therefore it is a multi-class classification problem. So we use a multi-class neural net here. And instead of using the default setting for the neural net, we are using the customized definition of the script. This NetSharp language define the topology of the deep nets that we are going to use. Here we have two hidden layers of the convolutional net, and then in the last layer we have 100 dimension of the vector. So each pixel is represented by 100 dimension of the feature vectors. And then this output, this last layer is going to feed into activation function to get the final classification result. So once I click the run, this experiment is going to run from the beginning to the end. And it usually takes a couple of minutes to finish. Today it finished really quick. So, once we saw every module has a green check mark around it, it means that this experiment has run successfully. And then we can see the performance of the model by collecting the output part of the evaluation model. So here we can see the overall accuracy of the deep neural nets can reach the accuracy of about 0.98, which is well above the human being. As a human being, the accuracy is about 0.97. So this shows that the deep neural nets can really capture the subtle change of the handwriting digits and then perform better than a human being. And the question may ask, so we have already finished the building of a deep neural nets model, then how can we put this model into production? How can we build a web service? So when, as a data scientist, usually we hand over the model to a developer, and the developer will translate the model into other languages and then put it into production. So usually this process can take about several weeks to several months, depending on the maturity of the current system. But with Azure Machine Learning, we can set up the web service by single clicks. So right now we are building the predictive experiment. So we can see that this is the model that we just trained from our training experiment using the deep neural nets. And then the input of the web service and output of the web service is automatically generated by Azure Machine Learning. And if you are not satisfied with the location of this input and output of the web service, you can also change it into other ports if you feel that is more accurate. So we need to hit the run to let the web service to learn the schema, what is the input for the web service and what is output for the web service. And by learning this, after the finish of the learning of the schema of the web service, we can deploy the web service with another one-click button. So, let's see. Yep. So we can see that this experiment already finished, and now we can click the button deploy web service. This will lead us to a new page. On this page, it shows the API key that is used to authenticate the calls to the web service that we just created. And also, it provides the links to two help documents. First is a simple REST API call, and the second is a batch call. So if we click the help document for the simple REST API call, we are going to see it provides the endpoint of the URL of the endpoint for the web service. See, this is an endpoint for the web service, and also the schema of the input and output parameter. In this demo, the input parameter is the pixel intensity, the intensity of each pixel for the image, and output parameter is that the classification result, which digit it is, and also together with the image intensity at the after the label. And also what's more is that we provide a sample code on the client side in Python, R, and C Sharp. So this will tells you how to this will guide you how to use this web service that we created. So right now, we build an experiment on the DrawMail and set up the web service. And then we are going to see how we can consume this web service through the phone. So seems that if I put it in full screen, it will go to that. Okay, let's see from here. So this is a mirror of my cell phone. And so there's an app called Digit Recognizer. And I can draw a digit here and then hit the send button. So after I hit this send button, the image that I just draw, I will send automatically to the API that we just created. And we can see that the classification result is returned back to the client side as the as number 3. So this shows us how easy that we can build the web service and how to deployed on the phone side. And let's stand back to see what we've covered in this demo. So on the Azure Machine Learning Studio, we build our model using the deep neural nets. And then we, with one or two click buttons, we build a web service that can be consumed by the client side, which is a cell phone in our demo. So besides what we provided here, the Cortana Analytics also provide easy access for the data ingestion. So the customer can upload their data to one of our cloud-based data storage. Either it is on the Azure Blobs or the traditional database like Azure SQL. Then we can use the Azure Data Factory, which connects the data on the cloud to the Azure ML, and then we can get that prediction from there. So, as a summary for today, the deep neural net is really a state-of-art machine learning algorithm, and it has changed dramatically the community of image processing, speech recognition, and natural language processing. And the biggest advantage of deep neural nets is that first, it does not require the manual feature engineering work. So usually the data scientists spend lots of time trying to get an optimal feature list that can boost the performance of the model. But with deep neural nets, every feature engineering is done within the process of the multiple layers. So there's no need to do further manual feature engineer work. And also, it has been proven that the deep neural nets can achieve very high accuracy in all these fields. And also, what we cover today is that on AzureML, we can provide a cloud-based platform for the users to build their customized deep neural nets, and the training can be done by specified topology using the NetSharp language on AzureML, and also AzureML provides an easy access to build the web service. And the last thing is that the Cortana Analytics Suite provides an end-to-end solution from the data ingestion, cloud-based computation, and then the consumption of the web service that we build. So that's pretty much what we want to show today. And any questions?
Thanks so much for the talk. First question is about using Azure ML to train a neural net. Do you guys currently have the capability to train them on a GPU, or if you're calling the API to say send a large image and it would also hit a GPU when it was being propagated through the network to reduce latency and improve performance?
So at this time, Azure does not have GPUs, but the keyword is this time.
Thanks.
So MATLAB and other languages already have powerful packages. So what are the advantages of using NetSharp instead of using the existing ones?
I'm personally not familiar with the...
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, so the question was about MATLAB and then why do this if there is MATLAB already. So I'm not super familiar with the MATLAB toolkit. I'm more familiar with like Caffe and Torch. Do you guys know how it specifies?
You usually have essentially two options, right? The first option is if you're familiar with the toolkits like Theano, is where you can do pretty much everything in Python, and then you have automatic or symbolic differentiation, and you can do everything. But then the question is, how simple is it to start and doing, simple stuff, I mean, even more complicated stuff, but simple. And in Theano, it's a little bit hard, in my opinion. And there are other frameworks like Caffe, where you have a domain-specific languages, which make things simpler. So our approach with NetSharp is basically to give you enough power and enough simplicity to build most of the model types.
But I guess your specific question, does MATLAB provide a DSL for doing actual, not only topologies, but the computation and kind of variables inside the topology?
I'm not sure on that, but you can do multi-class classification with multiple hidden layers and other things as well.
Right, so I think so that everyone, like including Weka, and I'm sure like the multiple packages for R, everyone can do fully connected and probably multiple layers of fully connected and even some basic convolutions. The key point is that like once you want to do something more powerful, where you want to have specific types of convolutions, advanced types of convolutions. The connectivity is coming, take into account that I have multiple channels. As far as we know, there is nobody else has an actual DSL language for topologies. I would say that in a nutshell, that's the key differentiator.
Thank you.
Hello, right over here.
Oh.
Hey, how's it going? Yeah. So my question is probably not going to be anywhere near as complex as that one, so you'll forgive me for it. But how well do your image search algorithms work with, say, classifying images or documents into groups and families, and we don't really know ahead of time what those groups and families would look like? Your example, you had a set of numbers, you knew what the true values were, and you threw it at it and trained the network, and it was able to pick out from that family from there. A case example that I've got in mind is I've got thousands of PDF files from 20 years ago, and I kind of want to classify them into structures and forms so I can get some poor summer student or a good text reading algorithm to run on top of it, but I need to know what those form structures look like ahead of time. So where's the question in that? Throwing a lot of unstructured images at a neural network and getting it to come up with, here's your top 10 most similarly structured document pages, and then trying to write something on top of that, for instance.
So there's, I think there's at least two ways you could go about it. So one is that you really are asking about a clustering problem, it sounds like. Like your first problem is just to, like, okay, you have a bunch of stuff, you want to find groups.
Yeah, I'd like to find patterns in the overall documents and then cluster based on those patterns.
Right. So one possibility is then just treat it as a clustering problem, but then you need featurization for it. To featurize it, then you can either use a neural net to basically come up with a good representation, and then you can train it on a few examples of forms, basically define some problem like just forms versus documents. It actually will not, the key point is that the net will learn what features kind of describe this text in a more comprehensible way, and then you can plug that into like k-means or any standard clustering algorithm. So again, this is going back to where you first train it as a discriminative problem, but then you throw out whatever the problem was and just treat it as a featurizer. Another possibility is not doing the nets at all and then just having higher order features basically from literature that you define through R, or like finding R packages for that, and then just using things like topic detection LDA. To see if that gives you better topics or clusters. But I mean, with any unsupervised problem, it's always somewhat a crapshoot in terms of what you'll get. Your best bet usually is to actually spend a bit of time labeling some and then kind of bootstrap from that, because otherwise you don't know if it'll just give you, you know, the certain bigger images versus smaller images or without any supervision.
Thank you very much.
I think this is working. NetSharp seems pretty cool. Are you going to create it as an open standard? In theory, would I be able to take a topology definition out of Azure and run it on some other platform like Weka?
So we'll be, we'll be very happy to in terms of standardizing it. I think the harder part is then that means that, you know, either the guys from New Zealand or us have to then modify Weka to actually take it as input, right? So it's certainly a possibility. I don't think there's anything conceptually, if we had more people, that would be a fun project to do, or if folks from Waikato want to do it, we'll be happy to help them with. I guess standardizing would be the first step. We haven't taken any steps towards that, but if you think that's good, I would love to hear more feedback and sort of about the benefits so that we could dedicate the resources.
It's basically demand-based. If we see a lot of demand, then yeah, certainly. We'll try. It's not because we don't want to. We actually want to. We just don't have enough resources. Sorry.
Hi. I was wondering. So you mentioned max pooling, where it kind of searches the images for, you know, a subset that has the biggest signal. And my question is, like, in the howold.net website, it zeroes in on the person's face. If I created it, how do I do that in ScriptSharp? If ScriptSharp even supports that, what kind of like neural network output would that be?
So right now, the object localization, one of the most popular techniques, which was published relatively recently, is essentially using the output of the the pooling layers as a heat map mm-hmm. to detect the object location. So I would say that in NetSharp itself, you can certainly do that. So you can take the potentially you can same as with the featureizers, right? Mm-hmm. Right, you remove the last layer and you get the features, mm-hmm. And then you can remove any number of layers and you can say take the features or the output signals from the max pooling layer, and then perform the object location. I think the right now the Azure ML, the way it's implemented in Azure ML, it doesn't support that. But the NetSharp, yeah. That really doesn't care. You can take outputs from any layer.
I see. So if you'd have to create a pipeline that splits mm-hmm. the image into parts and then runs the each section through a network and get, you know, the max signal.
Yes, actually, these days you even have to run the image only once and then you get a heat map.
Okay.
So you don't even have to, yes. So the previous approach was mm-hmm. to split the image mm-hmm. and then compute the heat map based on the multiple fragments, but the recent research shows that you can use the output of the max pooling layers.
Okay, thank you.
Once you use the Azure compute power to create a model, and that model is generated, is there any way that you can extract out the details of that model and reconstruct it yourself and be able to access it in an environment outside of Azure, or is Azure the only access point like through that API to get to your model, if that makes sense?
Right now it is. That's the way the product was put together.
Okay. and that's the design like going forward too?
I think rather than we could call it design, we could call it a decision, a business decision.
Okay, that makes sense.
But we're not business guys, so don't ask us.
Hi, I have a question about image feature and facial recognition and matching, which I played with a bit, and it seemed to work pretty well. My question has to do with image resolutions, because at the end of the day, with a web-based service or a cloud-based service, you have to actually ship the image or images to the service in order to get them processed and get results back. Do you have any guidance or experimentation to discuss the degree to which the resolution of the image impacts the accuracy of the results? In other words, you know, if I'm taking an 8-megapixel picture of a face, does it give me, you know, notably better recognition than if it was a, you know, 256 pixel image of the face?
So yes, there are limitations of the input size for the web service. So what is recommended right now is to convert the image, the pixel level image, into the Base64 coded image. That is using a string to represent the intensity of the image. So by doing this, it can dramatically lower the transmission cost for the web API. And for your question about whether the high resolution of the image can have a better performance in the recognition, based on my experience, usually it is, but it also depends. Yeah, since for example for the Amnis dataset, it is quite small. It is only 28x28, but we can still have a very good result. Yeah.
So yes, it really depends on the your dataset and on the labels. So for the Amnis, yes, 28x28 is more than enough. It actually can be downsampled even more. If you take something like more realistic, the same ImageNet, which are the just the pictures, real life, the photographs. Then empirically, people found that the image size of around 200x200 pixels is fine. And basically, going from 200 from the picture of 200x200 to say 500x500 doesn't improve the accuracy much. again, if you look into numerous Kaggle competitions, people are getting very good results, sometimes on relatively complicated data sets with relatively small images, like 64 by 64, which is very small, or like an order of 100 by 100.
You can also play tricks in terms of whether you downsample it or the resolution on the client, or you push it into Azure Blob, and then the input, as opposed to taking it off the wire, is you're just sending the location of the blob, so the actual big image is coming in within the data center. So you can always try to do things like that.
Another quite popular trick is the you do the prediction, you do so-called multi-view predictions. It helps to improve the end accuracy, and the cost is the more computation. Basically, you take the image, and then you take multiple views, and then you average the predictions. That might also help. If you think that your images sort of they require this high resolution.
Right here.
Hi. I was wondering what your thoughts are on the deep neural network for particularly different domains. Does it seem to work well where there are structure, so a small unit finally constitute to the final output that we are expecting? So for instance, in face recognition, we have ears, eyes, they constitute the face that we are looking for. In terms of NLP, we start with characters that form words and then ultimately sentence that we want to. But from our experience, we see that especially in healthcare data, where there is no such structure that we can look forward, it seems that deep neural network doesn't really help. So do you think that could be a reason why in some field we see deep neural network really beating state of the art for 10 decades that we've seen, but in some it fails to do so?
Yes, the answer is yes. So I think even like when you have, like say in something like web search, where you have like heterogeneous features from text, from historical data, and so on, and you don't have the obvious structure to exploit, like in the images, yeah, deep nets, I mean, they just become a strong nonlinear learner, but there's nothing fundamentally better about them compared to, say, boosted trees or random forest. They're not bad, but there's nothing special about them compared to others.
Yeah, that's a valid point. For example, people tried to use the deep nets on, I think it was a malware competition, and actually they tried a lot, and I think they came up the third result after boosted decision trees and some
or ensemble. I mean, in the end, like ensembles of everything always win.
So
if
the
you
neural,
care about
of course, deep neural nets cannot be answered for everything, but for example, they work very good in there is a field that is machine translation, like neural machine translation. It's been shown that they work very well. Another area where you can apply neural nets to text problems is the semantic, search semantic similarity. And this is the acronym that Misha showed on one of his slides, DSSM, Deep Structured Semantic Models, where you can basically extract the same features as you extract, same sort of features as you extract in images, but that's related to the text, so sort of extracting the semantics from the text.
So we're being told to get off stage. Thank you very much, and we'll be happy to take any questions offline.